following Pirkei Avot with Rabbeinu Yonah. And we were up to the third chapter, the 11th Mishnah. Rabbi Elazar HaModai had taught us, Hamchalelet HaKodashim, he who desecrates holy foods. We have sacrifices that are supposed to remain holy, and a person defiles them. Hamvazet HaMoadot, or someone who treats Chol HaMoed. We know within every holiday we have the beginning and the end, and then in the middle of Sukkot and Pesach, we have days which in which we can do much more tasks. We're more lenient, what's called Chol HaMoed. So in Mishnah, these days are referred to as Moed. You rarely find the term Chol HaMoed in Tanakh literature. But if someone treats them disrespectfully, so instead of honoring them, wearing nice clothing and doing respectful things, he treats them disrespectfully. He mows his lawn. You're not supposed to mow your lawn on Chol HaMoed. V'ameifer brito shel Avraham Avinu, and someone who annuls the covenant of Abraham. So it can be someone who doesn't circumcise their children. It can be someone who tries to undo their own circumcision. V'amalbin ne chaverov barabim, or someone who shames his friend publicly. So on all of these, plus one more, even if a person has acquired Torah and good deeds, he does not have a portion for the world to come, okay? So what were the things we listed? Desecrating the food of the temple, defiling it on purpose, purposely treating Chol HaMoed disrespectfully, undoing the covenant of Abraham, shaming a friend publicly, right? So those were four. There's a fifth. A person doesn't have a portion for the world to come, even if he's done other positive things. These are so weighty. So that's what we're up to. Shaming a friend publicly. V'amalbin pnei chaverov barabim. Zehu toladat advarim sheyareg behem ve'al yavo. The Rabbeinu Yonah is now telling us a fascinating concept. We know that there are three mitzvot that one should rather give up their life than transgress, right? V'havotim, we have three mitzvot which are avodat kochavim, idol worship. If they tell a person, bow down to this Buddha, to this Zeus, or die, then he should rather give up his life. Gilui arayot, the prohibited relations. So they tell a person to be intimate with his sister, with his mother, with a married woman, or die. Anyone, you know, I gave three examples, there are more. So then he has to rather give up his life. V'shvichut damim, or murder. So we ordinarily assume that we have three, and that's it. Rabbeinu Yonah says, no, the three are prototypes. The three are what we call avot. They are the roots, but there are derivatives. And so Rabbeinu Yonah says, shaming a friend publicly is a tolada. It is a derivative of these three. Toladat avodat kochavim atzei asherah. He says, an example. The Torah tells us you're not allowed to serve an idol, and you have to give up your life for it. Well, an extension of that would be the asherah wood, the asherah tree. Uchadamrinan, as the Talmud says in Tractate Psachim, b'chol mitrapein chutz me'atzei asherah. One who has to cure oneself can do anything. We say you don't have to have a kosher symbol on a medicine. If a person is ill, they're allowed to eat the medicine they need, even if it's not kosher. A person's allowed to use anything to get better, right, to save one's life, except for the wood of an Asherah tree. Asherah was a tree that was worshipped, so you're not allowed to use that wood to get cured. There was a big issue here in Jerusalem a century ago. There weren't hospitals. And what happened across the world for the last millennium is that the church would set up hospitals, and when you attended those hospitals, you weren't only attending their hospital. Sometimes they would actually force people to pray or bow to the figure they had on a wall in order to receive treatment. And so there was a rabbi here in Jerusalem 100 years ago, I'm sure you all heard of him, his name was Rabbi Cook. And he publicly came out and told people, you're not allowed to go to that hospital. There was a time that the church ensured that no one else could open up a hospital here in Jerusalem. The only hospital was a Christian hospital. And it was a center of missionary activity. And Rav Kook told people, it doesn't matter if you're going to die. This is part of the prohibition of of idol worship. You're not allowed to benefit from that hospital. Rav Kook was at the forefront of that battle. He said to people, don't cave in. Now, the situation was that they ensured that there were no midwives other than that hospital. How do you give birth? You know, so coming back to the Mishnah, Rabbeinu Yonah says the extension of Yehareg Ve'al Yavor of Avodah Zarah, an extension of that is the Asherah treatment.
Back to extension of Avodah Zarah.
And even though the Asherah tree is not, the Asherah wood is not really the idol itself, it's a supporter, it's something that was used in the service, but it wasn't the idol itself. Nonetheless, a person has to prefer giving up their life rather than getting cured by it. Well, Asherah was part of a pagan worship. Asherah was
So, is there a specific tree?
I don't know.
Wood and like, so this one will be designated as Asherah wood.
I don't know.
Okay, so it used to be for idol worship, but in disuse, does that still apply?
Oh, so let's take a step back, because this is relevant to our parsha. In our parsha, the Torah says, "Lo titan lecha Asherah." Don't plant an Asherah tree. So what's an Asherah tree? So there are multiple opinions. The first opinion says that when they used to set up a place of idol worship, one of the things they did was they plant a tall tree, which was a way of denoting this is the place where we worship the idol. It was a sign for the place, and that's the Asherah tree. Okay, so that's one pshat. The accepted pshat is that they used to plant a tree and worship that tree. A third pshat, which the Talmud brings, is that they used to plant a tree and place an idol under the tree and worship the idol under the tree. So they'd be bowing down to the tree, but really they were bowing to the idol under the tree. So we have three pshatim. Pshat number one is they were worshiping... Baruch haba. Pshat number one is they were worshiping... They just designated it as a marker. They worshipped the idol. They worshipped the idol they had there, but the tree was a marker. And the Torah says, don't plant any trees by the temple. I don't want these markers like the pagans did. But the more accepted pshatim are two pshatim that we have in the Gemara. One is that it was a tree they would worship. I don't know if they had specific species that they worshipped. I don't know. But they worshipped a tree which was called an Asherah tree. That's the well-known pshat. And then there's another pshat the Talmud brings that they worshipped an idol under the tree. They would bury an idol at the roots. At any rate, if we go with the first or third pshat, so then the tree itself is not the idol. And then that's probably what Rabbeinu Yonah is going with, that's an extension of the prohibition. Now... can an idol become permissible? So the Talmud in Tractate of Avodah Zarah says the following. If a non-Jew takes an idol and says, this is worthless, this is nothing. The Talmud says very often at wars, when the people would be fleeing a city, so they'd throw their idol. They'd say, what good are you? You didn't help me out here. Right? So if we can see that they damaged the idol, that they did something that shows that they no longer believe in it. So the Talmud says, just like the non-Jew can designate something as an idol, he can annul that designation. The Talmud says that in King David's forces, there was a man, we know in Tanakh, he's called Ittai HaGitti. Ittai from the city of Gat. Now Gat was a Philistine city. So the Talmud says, Ittai HaGitti used to go in first after we were victorious at a war. And before David would take in loot, Ittai would go in and go through the loot and take any pagan god which was in the loot and say, this is no longer a god, this is nonsense. A non-Jew can do that. The Talmud says, once it enters Jewish possession, it is forever prohibited from deriving benefit from. You burn it, you destroy it, The Talmud says only one non-Jew can do it, either to his own or to another non-Jew's idol. And that's why Ittai, it seems, never converted. Ittai would go in before King David, and he would annul the idols so that we can actually take them in with our loot. That's in an answer to Aviel's question. Back to Rabbeinu Yonah. Yaakov, he's bringing scissors, the Madrich. Back to Rabbeinu Yonah. Toladot gilui arayot, an extension of the prohibition of the illicit relationships. Hamistakelo amdaberim eshet ish, sheyareg aleihem v'al yavor. If a person looks at or speaks to in a flirting way with a married woman, kahu uvda b'masechta Sanhedrin. The Talmud tells us a scary story in Tractate Sanhedrin. It says, "B'mishala libatina." There was a man whose heart started making heart trouble, and the doctors said, "Well, there's this married woman who he's crazy over. So if you let him sleep with her, he'll be cured." So the rabbi said, "Tell him to drop dead." So the doctors said, Tamod lefanav aruma. So the doctor said, let her stand before him without clothing, and then he'll calm down. And the rabbi said, let him drop dead. And the Talmud quotes the story without telling us details. But the real story we have in another source. I think it's worth going on a tangent. The real story is quoted in part by Rashi in a different tractate, and it's quoted in full by Rabbeinu Nisim in his work Sefer Maasiyot. Rabbeinu Nisim, his father-in-law, suffered numerous tragedies, and then he sent him a letter and he said to him, you know, the Christians have these books that encourage you in difficult times. Don't let me go read their books. Write me a Jewish book that will encourage me in my difficult time. And so Rabbeinu Nisim wrote a book, a storybook. Rabbeinu Nisim was a giant. He knew the whole Shas by heart because he had the title Gaon, which meant he had already mastered the whole Shas, knew it all by heart. And his father-in-law asked him, so he wrote a storybook. And in that storybook, he discusses Jewish philosophies that emanate from the stories and how the stories should encourage us. So it's a beautiful work, which we studied here twice. The full book is online, available on the website. And in that book, he quotes the following story. There was once a man who had a beautiful wife, and there was a wealthy person who lived in their town. His name was Natan, this wealthy person. And Natan got very excited about this guy's wife, and he got so excited that he fell ill, and he was lying there deathly ill. And the doctors came to check him out, and the doctors said he will only be cured if he will be cured if this person lets Natan sleep with his wife. And so they went to the rabbis, and the rabbis said, tell Natan to drop dead. Natan was not too learned. So Natan brought in the doctors again, and they checked him, and they came back, and they said, well, he can be cured if she stands before him without clothing. And the rabbi said, tell Natan to drop dead. And then, so they called in the doctors a third time, and the doctor said, well, if she just stands there and talks to him, and he sees that a little bit he's had something, then Natan will be cured. The rabbi said, tell Natan to drop dead. And then, this is in the generation of Rabbi Akiva, as we will see at the end of the story. And then the doctor said, well, let her stand behind a fence. Let him feel to some degree that he had his desires fulfilled. She'll stand behind a fence. He won't see her, but he'll talk to her. And the rabbi said, tell Natan to drop dead. So Natan stayed in bed deathly ill. Now, as time went on, this man entered heavy debt. And he entered such heavy debt that he was imprisoned. And every day his wife would come to prison and bring him food. And one day here, the husband tells the wife, look, we know that Natan's been dying to have you, and I'm dying here in prison of hunger. So I know you're bringing me food every day, but my situation is terrible. Go get money from Natan. If you go to Natan, you'll get money. And she says to him, you brute. All these years I've been so chaste. How can you? You're crazy. I'm going to go to Natan. I put myself out and I bring you food and I do everything right. and you're sending me to Natan? I can't believe you did that. And she leaves him. She storms out, and she doesn't show up the next day with food. And he's there in prison. He can't do anything. And finally, when she shows up, he's so upset at her. He tells her, how could you do that? How could you do that to me? I don't have food. I'm dying here. You got to go to Natan. He's got all this money, and he's been wanting to talk to you for years, and now you'll just go and get the... So she says, I can't believe you're telling me to do that. And if you're going to tell me to do that, at one point, she gives in. And she goes to Natan's house. She reaches the front gate, and the servant sees her, and he runs into Natan, who's lying deathly ill in bed, and he tells him, you won't believe it! The lady's here! She's at the front gate! Natan says, if what you're telling me is true, I am freeing you on the spot, and I'm giving you a whole stash of money. And she comes to the door of the house and knocks on the door. And the next servant runs to him and says, Natan, you won't believe it. This lady's here. She just knocked on the front door. And Natan says, if that's true, you're also free, and I'm giving you a whole stash of money. And he's lying there in bed, and she walks into the room, and the servant closes the door behind her. And Natan gets up like a lion from bed, and she says to him, look, I have no choice. My husband asked me to come here. And I need money from you. And I know what you want, and you know what you want. And so I don't have a choice right now. But, Natan, I want you to remember, there's a God in heaven, and this is your moment. And if you will take control of yourself and you won't do something that's wrong, you will forever be happy. You will have done the right thing. And so, Natan, I want you to think for a minute, because I'm not going to stop you, but I want you to think, because you have two choices now. You can destroy your whole life, or you can conquer your whole life. And now's the moment where you have to decide. And Natan stood there and started crying. And Natan was fighting himself. Tremendous battle of wills. His whole life, you know, for years now, he's been wanting one thing. And now that he has it, she's telling him, Natan, you can be tremendous. And so Natan becomes one of the greatest heroes of Jewish history when Natan takes control of himself and he asks her, how much money do you need? And he gives her the loan, and she walks out and nothing happens. But the story doesn't end there. She comes back to her husband and she says, I was by Natan and nothing happened. He just gave us the money. And we have it, and you can come out of jail. And she pays off his debts, and the husband comes out of jail and says, you committed adultery. I can't believe you did that. And the woman pleads and says, I didn't. And he says, well, then why would Natan give you all this money? Obviously you did. And from that day onward, their marriage is on the rocks. Here she did everything he wanted. Guys, there's a lesson in this story about us men. You know, she did everything he wanted and better, and she has to suffer because he believes she was unfaithful. And so their marriage goes on until one day, Rabbi Akiva is teaching his students. And as he's teaching his students, he says to them, an angel's here. And they look out the window of the academy, and there is Natan riding on his horse. And Rabbi Akiva says, guys, you see that? There's so much light emanating from that Jew on the horse. That Jew is an angel. And they say, that's no angel. And Rabbi Akiva says, yes, he is. Don't you see all the light? Don't you see how holy he is? So the students say, well, that's Natan. Rabbi Akiva says, that's Natan who's holy. And Rabbi Akiva runs out of the academy and he calls him and he says, tell me, who are you? What's your story? How did you get such a shine? And then Natan tells him the story and Rabbi Akiva takes him in and Rabbi Akiva gives him the nickname Natan de Tzutzita. Tzutzita is like the word nitzotzot. Natan, who has sparks flying out of him. And Rabbi Akiva adopts him to teach him Torah. He says, a man like you should learn Torah. After what you've done, you're so holy, you should be learning Torah. And so Rabbi Akiva takes him in, and then Rabbi Akiva summons that man and his wife, and he tells the man, you're wrong, nothing happened there. I'm telling you, I didn't know who this person was, but I saw the holiness. That holiness stems from the fact that he conquered his desire. He had the greatest challenge, and he stood up to the challenge. And then their marriage went back to being peaceful. So that's the full story of Natan de Tzitzita. Now, if you open the Talmud, so the Talmud doesn't give you this whole story. The Talmud just says that if a person gets all excited over a woman, so even if they say, let him just look at her, even if they say, let him just talk to her, she'll stand on the other side of the fence. So then we say, the rabbi said, let him drop dead. That's not happening. So, says Rabbeinu Yonah, that's an extension of Gilui Arayot. You see, the Torah doesn't say a person should drop dead rather than talk to a woman. You talk to women all the time. Ah, but in this case, the rabbi said talking to her represented that. Should I give you guys, should we go into one more tangent?
One question on that is, do you believe that the rabbis in this case knew just talking to her from a fence wouldn't remain there? Otherwise,
no.
Otherwise, it's because
no. No, so that's exactly the point.
That's the same thing as sleeping with her in this case.
So the rabbis taught us an important principle here. The rabbi said, to talk to a woman is permissible, but to talk because a person has lust for a woman is prohibited. When the man says, I'm dying, I need to talk to her, the rabbi said, no.
Right,
right. But that's what Rabbeinu Yonah is saying. Look at how the extension, there's an extension of the prohibition, and it reaches the point where the rabbi say he can die. We're not going to let the daughters of Israel become cheap.
I thought of Esther's story when you gave that story. He would have, when the doors closed, could she be the kaka? What's her excuse? Anyway,
not so simple. No. Yeah.
Just to understand the story a little better. The last thing makes sense now, but basically, the way he got into debt and into, jail eventually, I want to ask if there's a connection to the fact that he also declined the fact that even just standing outside the gate, even if the rabbis were right, is there a connection that he ended up in jail with the fact that he let a man go dying?
The rabbis ruled that you're not allowed to do it, and it's in the Rambam.
I understand, but I'm just asking yes or no. Is there?
I don't think so.
That makes sense. That's making a more clean story.
Yeah. So, quick tangent. Our story goes back a decade and a half ago, a little bit more, close to two decades ago. I was still single, and I dated a girl. And by the second or third date, she decided we have to get married. And by the fifth date, I decided we shouldn't continue dating. On the fifth date, I told her, I really enjoyed getting to know you, and I don't think we match for marriage. And she said, but we're supposed to get married. And I said, I don't think so. I don't think we should continue. And she said, you're wrong. I said, maybe, but I have to go with what I understand. And she said, I'm not going to date anyone else till you change your mind. And I said, I don't think that's the right way to go. You have to move on with your life. And she said, you have to work with what you understand. And if you're breaking up, that's fine. But I have to work with what I understand. And to me, it is clear that we're supposed to be husband and wife. And so I'm not doing anything else. I said to her, I have to leave the country, and the government hasn't yet given me authorization to come back. I in 2 or 3 months, I have to leave, and I don't know if or when I'm coming back. I'd like to come back, but right now I have a problem with my papers. I don't know. It could take me years to come back now. So I don't think you should wait around for me. If this would have worked out, so we would have worked it out together. I hope I'll work it out. I expect to work it out. But I can't know exactly how long it's going to take. You have to move on with life. And she said, fine, I wish you well. I'll think it over. Fine. 6 months later, I'm in Chutzlartz. I get a call. Her father calls me and tells me she's not dating anyone. She's waiting for you. I come back to Israel. It's 8 or 9 months later. And her father shows up in yeshiva and tells me, will you go out with my daughter again? And I said, I really don't see the reason to do that because I don't think we match. And he says, look, I'm asking you a personal favor. Go out with her again, and if by the end of the date, or you'll do two dates or whatever, if you come to the same conclusion, then take the time to explain it to her so that she goes on in life. You have to do that. So I said, let me think about it. I wasn't sure. And part of what bothered me was this story. So I called up one of my teachers, and I said, am I allowed to do this? I don't think I'm going to marry this girl. What am I going out on a date talking to this girl for? I don't think so. I don't think we match. And my Rebbe said, go. You're not going to date. You're not going to talk like the story. She thinks you're supposed to get married. You're going to go on that date, and if by the end of the date you're still convinced you guys don't match, then you'll sit down and talk to her, and you'll explain it to her, and you'll explain it to her until she's come to terms with it so she could go on with life. For sure you should do that chesed with a fellow Jew. It's not the same story. Ah, she's saying, I must marry you, I must talk to you. Yeah, it's not the same deal. It's not out of lust, it's that she's got this juke in her head that she has to marry you. So, go and talk to her, get it out of her. It's not the same story. I'm just telling you, when I initially looked at it, I asked myself, is it similar? Because what's she saying? I have to marry you. So it's the reverse. It's not, you know, it's not the guy saying it about the girl, but it's the girl saying it about the guy. And my Rebbe said no. He said, no, go. I went on the date. I don't remember. I did end up going on two dates with her. I wasn't so quick to decide. I don't remember. And then I spoke to her at length, and Baruch Hashem, she went out, and I prayed she should get married before me. I didn't want her to suffer hearing that I got married. I really prayed she should get married before me. I was daven for her every day, and Baruch Hashem, she did. She got married before me.
Of course, if you were married to someone else at the time, your Rebbe would say, don't go. That's a big difference.
That's an interesting question. I never thought of that. So Rabbeinu Yonah says, we have extensions of the prohibitions. V'toldat shfichut tamim. So Rabbeinu Yonah says, our Mishnah tells us the extension of murder. You're not allowed to murder, and you got to give up your life rather than murder. Says Rabbeinu Yonah, shaming someone publicly is an extension of that prohibition. An extension of the prohibition of murder is amalbin pnei chaviro barabim. Someone who shames someone else publicly. When a person gets embarrassed, they turn red, and then the water, the blood leaves their face, and they turn ash. They turn white. As the Talmud says in Tractate Bam Metziah, Chazina Leidazil Sum Kavati Chivra. The Talmud says, look at a person, he turns red, and then he turns white. And that's what the Mishnah was teaching us, that someone who shames someone publicly does not have a portion in the world to come, because it's an extension of the prohibition of murder. We have only 4 lines left, so let's finish the Mishnah, and then we'll transfer. Someone who is brazen in Torah. So what does that mean, he's brazen in Torah? Most commentaries do not interpret this the way Rabbeinu Yonah does. Most commentaries say it means there are people who take the Torah and they define it the way they think is right, irrespective of tradition. That's what it means, someone who's brazen in Torah. Rabbeinu Yonah does not interpret it that way. Rabbeinu Yonah says, that's a person who is willing to transgress publicly. He doesn't care if everyone sees him do what's wrong. It's the middle of Shabbos and he turns on his radio. He's driving with the radio full blast. Rabbeinu Yonah says the same is true about someone who is brazen towards those who learn Torah. He doesn't have a portion in the world to come. Rabbeinu Yonah says that's only if he doesn't do tshuva. All of the things we listed, you know, Herzl didn't circumcise his kids. Herzl didn't circumcise any of his children. That's a good question.
He was not learning at all, first of all. He should have known that.
He knew that.
Yeah. Most of his kids' descendants, we lost the Jewish people anyway, right?
Because he's like a huge
Wait. I just brought it as an example. Let's not go off on that tangent. Oh, okay. So we have here, but what would happen if a person didn't circumcise their kids, but then they did tshuva? What would happen if someone embarrassed someone publicly, and then they went and they apologized? You know, when I was new at the position in Kochav Yaakov, so I tried to get people awake during the speech, so sometimes I'd throw out a question, and I'd wait for people to give an answer, right? Just because people shouldn't fall asleep during the speech. So once I made a mistake, once I made this mistake, I was in the middle of giving a speech, and I asked a question about the parasha, and I called the kid by name, and I asked him, help me out here. And the kid was very shy, and when I asked the question and I called him by name, he turned red. Like, he got all embarrassed, he didn't say a word. So right away I made a mistake, and I apologized to him publicly. I said, you know, what I just did was wrong. I should not have called you out by name. I apologize. If I called you publicly, I want to apologize publicly. So a person can sometimes make a mistake. A person can embarrass someone, even if he didn't mean to do it. Well, he has to apologize. The concept we're saying here, a person doesn't have a portion for the world to come, well, that's only if he doesn't do tshuva. You could do tshuva. Rabbi Yonah says you should know that nothing stands in the way of tshuva. Tshuva is dynamite. It blows away the door. You don't have to have the right key. You did tshuva. That's it. You're building your way back. And that's what the Talmud says in Tractate Peah, that all the things we listed here, a person was brazen in Torah, a person purposely misinterpreted the Torah, a person undid his own circumcision, a person desecrated the holidays, all of these things are weighty transgressions, but tshuva can undo all of them. And that's, now we finish the 11th Mishnah.